he's discovered that others had been there before him, and there was nothing left but broken glass. There must have been riotous behavior of all sorts imaginable, until finally there had been no one left to keep it up. At ground level, it's dark as an armpit. A flashlight would come in handy, one of the wind-up kind. He should keep an eye out. He gropes and stumbles in the right direction, scanning the ground for a glimmer of the vicious white land crabs that come out of their burrows and scuttle around after dark. Those things can give you quite a nip. And after a short detour into a clump of bushes, he locates his cement hidey hole by stubbing his toe on it. He refrains from swearing. No way of telling what else might be prowling around in the night. He slides open the cache, fumbles blindly within it, retrieves the third of scotch. He's been saving it up, resisting the urge to binge, keeping it as a sort of charm. As long as he's known it was still there, it's been easier to get through time. This might be the last of it. He's certain he has explored every likely site within a day's out-and-back radius of his tree, but he's feeling reckless. Why hoard the stuff? Why wait? What's his life worth anyway, and who cares? Out, out, brief candle. He's served his evolutionary purpose, as fucking Crake knew he would. He's saved the children.
Fucking Crake!
He can't help yelling. Clutching the bottle with one hand, feeling his way with the other, he reaches his tree again. He needs both hands for climbing, so he knots the bottle securely into his sheet. Once up, he sits on his platform, gulping down the scotch and howling at the stars, haroo, until he's startled by a chorus of replies from right near the tree. Is that the gleam of eyes? He can hear panting.
Hello, my furry pals, he calls down. Who wants to be man's best friend?
In answer, there's a supplicating whine. That's the worst thing about wolvogs. They still look like dogs, still behave like dogs, pricking up their ears, making playful puppy leaps and bounces, wagging their tails. They'll sucker you in, then go for you. It hasn't taken much to reverse 50,000 years of man-canid interaction. As for the real dogs, they never stood a chance. The wolvogs have simply killed and eaten all those who'd shown signs of vestigial domesticated status. He's seen a wolvog advance to a yapping Pekingese in a friendly manner, sniff its bum, then lunge for its throat, shake it like a mop, and canter off with the limp body. For a while, there were still a few woebegone house pets scrounging around, skinny and limping, their fur matted and dull, begging with bewildered eyes to be taken in by some human, any human. The children of Crake hadn't fit their bill. They must have smelled weird to a dog, sort of like walking fruits, especially at dusk when the citrus oil insect repellent kicked in, and in any case, they'd shown no interest in puppy dogs as a concept, so the strays had concentrated on Snowman. He'd almost given in a couple of times. He'd found it hard to resist their ingratiating wriggles, their pitiful whining, but he couldn't afford to feed them. Anyway, they were useless to him. It's sink or swim, he'd told them. Sorry, old buddy. He'd driven them away with stones, feeling like a complete shit, and there haven't been any more lately. What a fool he'd been. He'd let them go to waste. He should have eaten them. Or taken one in, trained it to catch rabbits, or to defend him, or something. Wolvogs can't climb trees, which is one good thing. If they get numerous enough and too persistent, he'll have to start swinging from vine to vine like Tarzan. That's a funny idea, so he laughs.
All you want is my body, he yells at them.
Then he drains the bottle and throws it down. There's a yelp, a scuttling. They still respect missiles. But how long can that last? They're smart. Very soon they'll sense his vulnerability, start hunting him. Once they begin, he'll never be able to go anywhere, or anywhere without trees. All they'll have to do is get him out in the open, encircle him, close in for the kill. There's only so much you can do with stones and pointed sticks. He really needs to find another spray gun. After the wolvogs have gone, he lies on his back on the platform, gazing up at the stars through the gently moving leaves. They seem close, the stars, but they're far away. Their light is millions, billions of years out of date. messages with no sender. Time passes. He wants to sing a song but can't think of one. Old music rises up in him, fades. All he can hear is the percussion. Maybe he could whittle a flute out of some branch or stem or something, if only he could find a knife. "Starlight, star bright," he says. What comes next? It's gone right out of his head. No moon. Tonight is the dark of the moon, although the moon is there nevertheless and must be rising now. A huge invisible ball of stone, a giant lump of gravity, dead but powerful, drawing the sea towards itself, drawing all fluids. The human body is 98% water, says the book in his head. This time it's a man's voice, an encyclopedia voice. No one he knows or knew. The other 2% is made up of minerals, most importantly the iron in the blood and the calcium of which the skeletal frame and the teeth are comprised. "Who gives a rat's ass?" says Snowman. He doesn't care about the iron in his blood or the calcium in his skeletal frame. He's tired of being himself. He wants to be someone else. Turn over all his cells, get a chromosome transplant, trade in his head for some other head, one with better things in it. Fingers moving over him, for instance, little fingers with oval nails, painted ripe plum, or crimson lake, or rose petal pink. I wish I may, I wish I might, have the wish I wish tonight. Fingers, a mouth. A dull, heavy ache begins at the base of his spine. "Oryx," he says. "I know you're there." He repeats the name. It's not even her real name, which he'd never known anyway. It's only a word. It's a mantra. Sometimes he can conjure her up. At first she's pale and shadowy, but if he can say her name over and over, then maybe she'll glide into his body and be present with him in his flesh, and his hand on himself would become her hand. But she's always been evasive. You can never pin her down. Tonight she fails to materialize and he is left alone, whimpering ridiculously, jerking off all by himself in the dark. 6. Oryx. Snowman wakes up suddenly. Has someone touched him? But there's nobody there, nothing. It's totally dark, no stars. Clouds must have come in. He turns over, pulls his sheet around him. He's shivering. It's the night breeze. Most likely he's still drunk. Sometimes it's hard to tell. He stares up into the darkness, wondering how soon it will be morning, hoping he'll be able to go back to sleep. There's an owl hooting somewhere. That fierce vibration, up close and far away at once, like the lowest note on a Peruvian flute. Maybe it's hunting. Hunting what? Now he can feel Oryx floating towards him through the air, as if on soft, feathery wings. She's landing now, settling. She's very close to him, stretched out on her side, just a skin's distance away. Miraculously, she can fit onto the platform beside him, although it isn't a large platform. If he had a candle or a flashlight, he'd be able to see her, the slender outline of her, a pale glow against the darkness. If he put out his hand, he could touch her, but that would make her vanish. "It wasn't the sex," he says to her. She doesn't answer, but he can feel her disbelief. He's making her sad because he's taking away some of her knowledge, her power. "It wasn't just the sex." A dark smile from her, that's better. "You know I love you. You're the only one." She isn't the first woman he's ever said that to. He shouldn't have used it up so much earlier in his life. He shouldn't have treated it like a tool, a wedge, a key to open women. By the time he got around to meaning it, the words had sounded fraudulent to him, and he'd been ashamed to pronounce them. "No, really," he says to Oryx. No answer, no response. She was never very forthcoming at the best of times. "Tell me just one thing," he'd say, back when he was still Jimmy. "Ask me a question," she'd reply. So he would ask, and then she might say, "I don't know, I've forgotten," or, "I don't want to tell you that," or, "Jimmy, you are so bad, it's not your business." Once she'd said,
"You have a lot of pictures in your head, Jimmy. Where did you get them? Why do you think they are pictures of me?"
He thought he understood her vagueness, her evasiveness. "It's all right," he told her, stroking her hair. "None of it was your fault."
"None of what, Jimmy?"
How long had it taken him to piece her together from the slivers of her he'd gathered and hoarded so carefully? There was Craig's story about her, and Jimmy's story about her as well, a more romantic version. And then there was her own story about herself, which was different from both, and not very romantic at all. Snowman riffles through these three stories in his head. There must once have been other versions of her, her mother's story, the story of the man who'd bought her, the story of the man who'd bought her after that, and the third man's story, the worst man of them all, the one in San Francisco, a pious bullshit artist. But Jimmy had never heard those. Oryx was so delicate. Filigree, he would think, picturing her bones inside her small body. She had a triangular face, big eyes, a small jaw, a hymenoptera face, a mantid face, the face of a Siamese cat. Skin of the palest yellow, smooth and translucent, like old, expensive porcelain. Looking at her, you knew that a woman of such beauty, slightness, and one-time poverty must have led a difficult life, but that this life would not have consisted in scrubbing floors. "Did you ever scrub floors?" Jimmy asked her once.
"Floors?"
She thought a minute.
"We didn't have floors. When I got as far as the floors, it wasn't me scrubbing them."
One thing about that early time, she said, the time without floors, the pounded earth surfaces were swept clean every day. They were used for sitting on while eating and for sleeping on, so that was important. Nobody wanted to get old food on themselves. Nobody wanted fleas. When Jimmy was 7 or 8 or 9, Oryx was born. Where exactly? Hard to tell. Some distant, foreign place. "It was a village, though," said Oryx. "A village with trees all around and fields nearby, or possibly rice paddies. The huts had thatch of some kind on the roofs, palm fronds, although the best huts had roofs of tin. A village in Indonesia? Or else Myanmar?" "Not those," said Oryx, though she couldn't be sure. "It wasn't India, though. Vietnam?" Jimmy guessed. "Cambodia?" Oryx looked down at her hands, examining her nails. It didn't matter. She couldn't remember the language she'd spoken as a child. She'd been too young to retain it, that earliest language. The words had all been scoured out of her head. But it wasn't the same as the language of the city to which she'd first been taken, or not the same dialect, because she'd had to learn a different way of speaking. She did remember that, the clumsiness of the words in her mouth, the feeling of being struck dumb. "The village was a place where everyone was poor, and there were many children," said Oryx. She herself was quite little when she was sold. Her mother had a number of children, among them two older sons who would soon be able to work in the fields, which was a good thing, because the father was sick. He coughed and coughed. This coughing punctuated her earliest memories. Something wrong with the lungs, Jimmy had guessed. Of course, they all probably smoked like maniacs when they could get the cigarettes. Smoking dulled the edge. He'd congratulated himself on this insight. The villagers set the father's illness down to bad water, bad fate, bad spirits. Illness had an element of shame to it. No one wanted to be contaminated by the illness of another. So the father of Oryx was pitied, but also blamed and shunned. His wife tended him with silent resentment. Bells were rung, however. Prayers were said. Small images were burned in the fire. But all of this was useless, because the father died. Everyone in the village knew what would happen next, because if there was no man to work in the fields or in the rice paddies, then the raw materials of life had to come from somewhere else. Oryx had been a younger child, often pushed to the side, but suddenly she was made much of and given better food than usual, and a special blue jacket, because the other village women were helping out, and they wanted her to look pretty and healthy. Children who were ugly or deformed, or who were not bright or couldn't talk very well. Such children went for less, or might not be sold at all. The village women might need to sell their own children one day, and if they helped out, they would be able to count on such help in return. In the village, it was not called selling, this transaction. The talk about it implied apprenticeship. The children were being trained to earn their living in the wide world. This was the gloss put on it. Besides, if they stayed where they were, what was there for them to do? Especially the girls, said Oryx. They would only get married and make more children, who would then have to be sold in their turn. Sold or thrown into the river to float away to the sea, because there was only so much food to go around. One day a man came to the village. It was the same man who always came. Usually he arrived in a car, bumping over the dirt track, but this time there had been a lot of rain, and the road was too muddy. Each village had its own such man who would make the dangerous journey from the city at irregular intervals, although it was always known ahead of time that he was on his way. "What city?" asked Jimmy. But Oryx only smiled. Talking about this made her hungry, she said. Why didn't sweet Jimmy phone out for some pizza? Mushrooms, artichoke hearts, anchovies, no pepperoni.
You want some too? She said.
No, said Jimmy. Why won't you tell me?
Why do you care? Said Oryx. I don't care. I never think about it. It's long ago now.
This man, said Oryx, contemplating the pizza as if it were a jigsaw puzzle, then picking off the mushrooms, which she liked to eat first, would have two other men with him, who were his servants and who carried rifles to fend off the bandits. He wore expensive clothes, and except for the mud and dust, everyone got muddy and dusty on the way to the village, he was clean and well-kempt. He had a watch, a shiny gold-colored watch he consulted often, pulling up his sleeve to display it. This watch was reassuring, a badge of quality. Maybe the watch was real gold. There were some who said it was. This man wasn't regarded as a criminal of any sort, but as an honorable businessman who didn't cheat, or not much, and who paid in cash. Therefore he was treated with respect and shown hospitality, because no one in the village wanted to get on his bad side. What if he ceased to visit? What if a family needed to sell a child, and he would not buy it because he'd been offended on a previous visit? He was the villagers' bank, their insurance policy, their kind, rich uncle, their only charm against bad luck. And he had been needed more and more often because the weather had become so strange and could no longer be predicted. Too much rain, or not enough, too much wind, too much heat, and the crops were suffering. The man smiled a lot, greeted many of the village men by name. He always gave a little speech, the same one every time. He wanted everyone to be happy, he would say. He wanted satisfaction on both sides. He didn't want any hard feelings. Hadn't he bent over backwards for them, taking children that were plain and stupid and a burden on his hands just to oblige them? If they had any criticism of the way he conducted affairs, they should tell him. But there was never any criticism, though there was grumbling behind his back. He never paid any more than he had to, it was said. He was admired for this, however. It showed he was good at his trade, and the children would be in competent hands. Each time the gold wristwatch man came to the village, he would take several children away with him, to sell flowers to tourists on the city streets. The work was easy, and the children would be well treated, he assured the mothers. He wasn't a low-down thug or a liar. He wasn't a pimp. They would be well fed and given a safe place to sleep. They would be carefully guarded, and they would be paid a sum of money, which they could send home to their families or not, whatever they chose. This sum would be a percentage of their earnings minus the expense of their room and board. No money was ever sent to the village. Everyone knew it would not be. In exchange for the child apprentice, he would give the fathers or else the widowed mothers a good price, or what he said was a good price, and it was a decent enough price considering what people were used to. With this money, the mothers who sold their children would be able to give the remaining children a better chance in life. So they told one another. Jimmy was outraged by this the first time he heard about it. That was in the days of his outrage, also in the days of his making a fool of himself over anything concerning Oryx.
"You don't understand," said Oryx.
She was still eating the pizza in bed. With that, she was having a Coke and a side of fries. She'd finished with the mushrooms, and now she was eating the artichoke hearts. She never ate the crust. She said it made her feel very rich to throw away food.
Many people did it. It was the custom.
An asshole custom, said Jimmy. He was sitting on a chair beside the bed, watching her pink cat's tongue as she licked her fingers.
Jimmy, you are bad. Don't swear. You want a pepperoni? You didn't order them, but they put them on anyway. I guess they heard you wrong.
Asshole isn't swearing. It's only graphic description.
Well, I don't think you should say it.
She was eating the anchovies now. She always saved them till last. I'd like to kill this guy.
What guy? You want this Coke? I can't finish it.
The guy you just told me about.
Oh, Jimmy. You would like it better maybe if we all starved to death?
Said Oryx, with her small, rippling laugh. This was the laugh he feared most from her, because it disguised amused contempt. It chilled him. A cold breeze on a moonlit lake. Of course he'd marched his outrage off to Crake. He'd whammed the furniture. Those were his furniture-whamming days. What Crake had to say was this.
Jimmy, look at it realistically. You can't couple a minimum access to food with an expanding population indefinitely. Homo sapiens doesn't seem able to cut himself off at the supply end. He's one of the few species that doesn't limit reproduction in the face of dwindling resources. In other words, and up to a point, of course, the less we eat, the more we fuck.
Well, how do you account for that? Said Jimmy.
Imagination, said Craig. Men can imagine their own deaths. They can see them coming, and the mere thought of impending death acts like an aphrodisiac. A dog or a rabbit doesn't behave like that. Take birds. In a lean season, they cut down on the eggs, or they won't mate at all. They put their energy into staying alive themselves until times get better. But human beings hope they can stick their souls into someone else, some new version of themselves, and live on forever.
As a species, we're doomed by hope, then?
You could call it hope. That or desperation.
But we're doomed without hope as well, said Jimmy.
Only as individuals, said Crake cheerfully.
Well, it sucks.
Jimmy, grow up.
Crake wasn't the first person who'd ever said that to Jimmy. The wristwatch man would stay overnight in the village with his two servants and their guns, and would eat and then drink with the men. He would hand out cigarettes, entire packs of them, in gold and silver paper boxes, with the cellophane still on. In the morning, he would look over the children on offer and ask some questions about them. Had they been sick? Were they obedient? And he'd check their teeth. They had to have good teeth, he said, because they would need to smile a lot. Then he would make his selections and the money would change hands, and he'd say his farewells, and there would be polite nods and bows all round. He would take 3 or 4 children with him, never more. That was the number he could manage. This meant he could pick the best of the crop. He did the same in other villages in his territory. He was known for his taste and judgment. Oryx said it must have been too bad for a child not to be chosen. Things would be worse for it in the village then. It would lose value. It would be given less to eat. She herself had been chosen first of all. Sometimes the mothers would cry, and also the children. But the mothers would tell the children that what they were doing was good. They were helping their families, and they should go with the man and do everything he told them. The mothers said that after the children had worked in the city for a while and things were better, then they could come back to the village. No children ever came back. All of this was understood, and if not condoned, at least pardoned. Still, after the man had left, the mothers who had sold their children felt empty and sad. They felt as if this act, done freely by themselves, no one had forced them, no one had threatened them, had not been performed willingly. They felt cheated as well, as if the price had been too low. Why hadn't they demanded more? And yet, the mothers told themselves, they'd had no choice. The mother of Oryx sold 2 of her children at the same time, not only because she was hard up. She thought the 2 might keep each other company, look out for each other. The other child was a boy, 1 year older than Oryx. Fewer boys were sold than girls, but they were not therefore more valued. Oryx took this double sale as evidence that her mother had loved her. She had no images of this love. She could offer no anecdotes. It was a belief rather than a memory. The man said he was doing Oryx's mother a special favor, as boys were more trouble and did not obey, and ran away more often. And who would pay him for his trouble then? Also, this boy did not have a right attitude. That much was clear at a glance, and he had a blackened front tooth that gave him a criminal expression. But as he knew she needed the money, he would be generous, and would take the boy off her hands. Bird call. Oryx said she couldn't remember the trip from the village to the city, but she could remember some of the things that had happened. It was like pictures hanging on a wall, with around them the blank plaster. It was like looking through other people's windows. It was like dreams. The man with the watch said his name was Uncle N, and they must call him that, or there would be very big trouble. Was that N as in a name, or N as in an initial? Jimmy asked.
I don't know, said Oryx.
Did you ever see it written?
Nobody in our village could read, said Oryx. Here, Jimmy, open your mouth. I give you the last piece.
Remembering this, Snowman can almost taste it. The pizza, then Oryx's fingers in his mouth. Then the Coke can rolling onto the floor. Then joy, crushing his whole body in its boa constrictor grip. Oh, stolen, secret picnics. Oh, sweet delight. Oh, clear memory. Oh, pure pain. Oh, endless night. This man, Oryx continued later that night, or on some other night, this man said he was their uncle from now on. Now that they were out of sight of the village, he wasn't smiling so much. They must walk very quickly, he said, because the forest around them was full of wild animals with red eyes and long, sharp teeth, and if they ran in among the trees or walked too slowly, these animals would come and tear them to pieces. Oryx was frightened and wanted to hold hands with her brother, but that wasn't possible. Were there tigers? Jimmy asked. Oryx shook her head for no. No tigers. What were these animals, then? Jimmy wanted to know. He thought he might get some clues that way as to the location. He could look at the list of habitats. That might help.
They didn't have names, said Oryx. But I knew what they were.
At first, they went single file along the muddy road, walking on the side where it was higher, watching out for snakes. A gun-carrying man was at the front, then Uncle N, then the brother, then the two other children who had also been sold, both girls, both older, and then Oryx. At the end came the other gunman. They stopped for a noon meal, cold rice it was, packed for them by the villagers, and then they walked some more. When they came to a river, one of the men with the guns carried Oryx across. He said she was so heavy he would have to drop her into the water, and then the fish would eat her, but that was a joke. He smelled of sweaty cloth and smoke, and some sort of perfume or grease that was in his hair. The water came up to his knees. After that, the sun was on a slant and got into her eyes. They must have been going west then, thought Jimmy, and she was very tired. As the sun got lower and lower, the birds began singing and calling, unseen, hidden in the branches and vines of the forest. Raucous croaks and whistles, and four clear sounds in a row, like a bell. These were the same birds that always called like this as dusk approached, and at dawn just before the sun came up, and Oryx was consoled by their sounds. The bird calls were familiar. They were part of what she knew. She imagined that one of them, the one like a bell, was her mother's spirit, sent out in the shape of a bird to keep watch over her, and that it was saying, "You will come back." In that village, she told him, some of the people could send their spirits out like that, even before they were dead. It was well known. You could learn how to do it. The old women could teach you. And that way you could fly everywhere. You could see what was coming in the future, and send messages, and appear in other people's dreams. The bird called, and called, and then fell silent. Then the sun went down abruptly, and it was dark. That night they slept in a shed. Possibly it was a shed for livestock. It had that smell. They had to pee in the bushes, all together in a row, with one of the gunmen standing guard. The men made a fire outside, and laughed and talked, and smoke came in, but Oryx didn't care because she went to sleep. Did they sleep on the ground, or in hammocks, or on cots? Asked Jimmy. But she said it wasn't important. Her brother was there beside her. He'd never paid very much attention to her before, but now he wanted to be close to her. The next morning they walked some more and came to the place where Uncle N's car had been left, under the protection of several men in a small village, smaller than their own village and dirtier. Women and children peered at them from the doorways but did not smile. One woman made a sign against evil. Uncle N checked to make sure nothing was missing from the car, and then he paid the men, and the children were told to get in. Oryx had never been inside a car before, and she didn't like the smell. It wasn't a solar car, it was the gasoline kind, and not new. One of the men drove, Uncle N beside him. The other man sat in the back with all four children jammed in beside him. Uncle N was in a bad temper and told the children not to ask any questions. The road was bumpy, and it was hot inside the car. Oryx felt sick and thought she would vomit, but then she dozed off. They must have driven for a long time. They stopped when it was night again. Uncle N and the man in front went into a low building, some sort of inn, perhaps. The other man stretched out on the front seat and soon began to snore. The children slept in the back of the car, as best they could. The back doors were locked. They couldn't get out of the car without climbing over the man, and they were afraid to do that because he would think they were trying to run away. Somebody wet their pants during the night. Oryx could smell it, but it wasn't her. In the morning they were all herded around to the back of the building, where there was an open latrine. A pig on the other side of it watched them while they squatted. After more hours of bumpy driving, they stopped where there was a gate across the road with two soldiers. Uncle N told the soldiers that the children were his nieces and his nephew. Their mother had died, and he was taking them to live in his own house, with his own family. He was smiling again. "You have a lot of nieces and nephews," said one of the soldiers, grinning. "That is my misfortune," said Uncle N. "And all their mothers die. This is the sad truth." "We aren't sure we should believe you," said the other soldier, also grinning. "Here," said Uncle N. He pulled Oryx out of the car. "What's my name?" he said to her, putting his smiling face down close. "Uncle N," she said. The two soldiers laughed, and Uncle N laughed also. He patted Oryx on the shoulder and told her to get back into the car and shook hands with the soldiers, putting his hand into his pocket first, and then the soldiers swung the gate open. Once the car was going along the road again, Uncle N gave Oryx a hard candy in the shape of a tiny lemon. She sucked it for a while and then took it out to keep. She had no pocket, so she held it in her sticky fingers. That night she comforted herself by licking her own hand. The children cried at night, not loudly. They cried to themselves. They were frightened. They didn't know where they were going, and they had been taken away from what they knew. Also, said Oryx, they had no more love, supposing they'd had some in the first place. But they had a money value. They represented a cash profit to others. They must have sensed that, sensed they were worth something. Of course, said Oryx, having a money value was no substitute for love. Every child should have love, every person should have it. She herself would rather have had her mother's love, the love she still continued to believe in, the love that had followed her through the jungle in the form of a bird so she would not be too frightened or lonely. But love was undependable. It came and then it went, so it was good to have a money value, because then at least those who wanted to make a profit from you would make sure you were fed enough and not damaged too much. Also, there were many who had neither love nor a money value, and having one of these things was better than having nothing. Roses. The city was a chaos, filled with people and cars and noise and bad smells and a language that was hard to understand. The four new children were shocked by it at first, as if they'd been plunged into a cauldron of hot water, as if the city was physically hurtful to them. Uncle N had experience, however. He treated the new children as if they were cats. He gave them time to get used to things. He put them into a small room in a three-story building on the third floor with a barred window they could look out but not climb out, and then he led them outside gradually, a short distance at first and an hour at a time. There were already five children staying in the room, so it was crowded, but there was enough space for a thin mattress for each child, laid down at night so the entire floor was covered with mattresses and children, then rolled up during the day. These mattresses were worn and stained and smelled of urine, but rolling them up neatly was the first thing the new children had to learn. From the other, more seasoned children, they learned more things. The first was that Uncle N would always be watching them, even when it appeared they had been left in the city on their own. He would always know where they were. All he had to do was hold his shiny watch up to his ear, and it would tell them, because there was a little voice inside it that knew everything. This was reassuring, as nobody else would be allowed to harm them. On the other hand, Uncle N would see if you didn't work hard enough, or tried to run away, or if you kept for yourself any of the money you got from the tourists. Then you would be punished. Uncle N's men would beat you, and then you would have bruises. They might burn you as well. Some of the children claimed to have endured these punishments, and were proud of it. They had scars. If you tried these forbidden things often enough, laziness, theft, running away, you would be sold to someone much worse, it was said, than Uncle N. Or else you would be killed and tossed on a rubbish heap, and nobody would care because nobody would know who you were. Oryk said that Uncle N really knew his business, because children would believe other children about punishments more readily than they would believe adults. Adults threatened to do things they never did, but children told what would happen, or what they were afraid would happen, or what had happened already, to them or to other children they'd known. The week after Oryx and her brother arrived in the mattress room, three of the older children were taken away. They were going to another country, said Uncle N. This country was called San Francisco. Was it because they'd been bad? No, said Uncle N. It was a reward for being good. All who were obedient and diligent might go there someday. There was nowhere Oryx wanted to go except home, but home was becoming hazy in her mind. She could still hear her mother's spirit calling, "You will come back." But that voice was becoming fainter and more indistinct. It was no longer like a bell. It was like a whisper. It was a question now, rather than a statement. A question with no answer. Oryx and her brother, and the other two newcomers, were taken to watch the more experienced children selling flowers. The flowers were roses, red and white and pink. They were collected at the flower market early in the morning. The thorns had been removed from the stems so the roses could be passed from hand to hand without pricking anyone. You had to loiter around the entranceways to the best hotels. The banks where foreign money could be changed and the expensive shops were good locations too. And you had to keep an eye out for policemen. If a policeman came near or stared hard at you, you should walk the other way quickly. Selling flowers to the tourists was not allowed unless you had an official permit, and such permits were too expensive. But there was nothing to worry about, said Uncle N. The police knew all about it, only they had to appear as if they didn't know. When you saw a foreigner, especially one with a foreign woman beside him, you should approach and hold up the roses, and you should smile. You should not stare or laugh at their strange foreign hair and water-colored eyes. If they took a flower and asked you how much, you should smile even more and hold out your hand. If they spoke to you asking questions, you should look as if you didn't understand. That part was easy enough. They would always give you more, sometimes much more, than the flower was worth. The money had to be put into a little bag hanging inside your clothes. That was to protect against pickpockets and random snatching from street urchins, those unlucky ones without an Uncle N to look after them. If anyone, especially any man, tried to take you by the hand and lead you off somewhere, you should pull your hand away. If they held on too tight, you should sit down. That would be a signal, and one of Uncle N's men would come, or Uncle N himself. You should never get into a car or go into a hotel. If a man asked you to do that, you should tell Uncle N as soon as possible. Oryx had been given a new name by Uncle N. All the children got new names from him. They were told to forget their old names, and soon they did. Oryx was now Susu. She was good at selling roses. She was so small and fragile, her features so clear and pure. She was given a dress that was too big for her, and in it she looked like an angelic doll. The other children petted her, because she was the littlest one. They took turns sleeping beside her at night. She was passed from one set of arms to another. Who could resist her? Not many of the foreigners. Her smile was perfect, not cocky or aggressive, but hesitant, shy, taking nothing for granted. It was a smile with no ill will in it. It contained no resentment, no envy, only the promise of heartfelt gratitude. Adorable, the foreign ladies would murmur, and the men with them would buy a rose and hand it to the lady, and that way the men would become adorable too. And Oryx would slip the coins into the bag down the front of her dress and feel safe for one more day, because she had sold her quota. Not so her brother. He had no luck. He didn't want to sell flowers like a girl, and he hated smiling. And when he did smile, the effect was not good because of his blackened tooth. So Oryx would take some of his leftover roses and try to sell them for him. Uncle Em didn't mind at first. Money was money. But then he said Oryx shouldn't be seen too much in the same locations, because it wouldn't do for people to become tired of her. Something else would have to be found for the brother, some other occupation. He would have to be sold elsewhere. The older children in the room shook their heads. The brother would be sold to a pimp, they said. A pimp for hairy, white, foreign men, or bearded brown men, or fat yellow men, any kind of men who liked little boys. They described in detail what these men would do. They laughed about it. He would be a melon bum boy, they said. That's what boys like him were called. Firm and round on the outside, soft and sweet on the inside. A nice melon bum for anyone who paid. Either that or he would be put to work as a messenger, sent from street to street, doing errands for gamblers, and that was hard work and very dangerous because the rival gamblers would kill you. Or he could be a messenger and a melon boy, both. That was the most likely thing. Oryx saw her brother's face darken and grow hard, and she wasn't surprised when he ran away. And whether he was ever caught and punished, Oryx never knew. Nor did she ask, because asking, she had now found out, would do no good. One day a man did take Oryx by the hand and say she should come into the hotel with him. She gave him her shy smile and looked up sideways and said nothing and pulled her hand away and told Uncle Anne afterwards. Then Uncle Anne said a surprising thing. If the man asked again, he said, she was to go into the hotel with him. He would want to take her up to his room, and she must go with him. She should do whatever the man asked, but she shouldn't worry, because Uncle N would be watching and would come to get her. Nothing bad would happen to her. "Will I be a melon?" she asked. "A melon bum girl?" And Uncle N laughed and said, "Where did she pick up that word?" But no, he said, that was not what would happen. Next day the man appeared and asked Oryx if she would like some money, a lot more money than she could make by selling roses. He was a long, white, hairy man with a thick accent, but she could make out the words. This time Oryx went with him. He held her hand and they went up in an elevator. This was the frightening part, a tiny room with doors that shut, and when the doors opened you were in a different place, and Uncle N hadn't explained about that. She could feel her heart thumping. "Don't be afraid," said the man, thinking she was afraid of him. But it was the other way around. He was afraid of her, because his hand had a tremor. He unlocked a door with a key, and they went in, and he locked the door behind them. And they were in a mauve and gold-colored room with a giant bed in it, a bed for giants. And the man asked Oryx to take off her dress. Oryx was obedient and did as she was told. She had a general idea of what else the man might want. The other children already knew about such things and discussed them freely and laughed about them. People paid a lot of money for the kinds of things this man wanted, and there were special places in the city for men like him to go. But some wouldn't go there because it was too public, and they were ashamed, and they foolishly wanted to arrange things for themselves, and this man was one of that kind. So Oryx knew the man would now take off his own clothes, or some of them, and he did, and seemed pleased when she stared at his penis, which was long and hairy like himself, with a bend in it, like a little elbow. Then he kneeled down so he was on her level, with his face right next to hers. What did this face look like? Oryx couldn't remember. She could remember the singularity of his penis, but not the singularity of his face.
"It was like no face," she said. "It was all soft, like a dumpling. There was a big nose on it, a carrot nose. A long white penis nose."
She laughed, holding her two hands over her mouth.
"Not like your nose, Jimmy," she added in case he felt self-conscious. "Your nose is beautiful. It is a sweet nose, believe me."
"I won't hurt you," said the man. His accent was so ridiculous that Oryx wanted to giggle, but she knew that would be wrong. She smiled her shy smile, and the man took hold of one of her hands and placed it on himself. He did this gently enough, but at the same time he seemed angry. Angry and in a hurry. That was when Uncle N plunged suddenly into the room. How? He must have had a key. He must have been given a key by someone at the hotel. He picked Oryx up and hugged her and called her his little treasure and yelled at the man, who seemed very frightened, and tried to scramble into his clothes. He got caught in his trousers and hopped around on one foot while trying to explain something with his bad accent, and Oryx felt bad for him. Then the man gave money to Uncle N, a lot of money, all the money in his wallet, and Uncle En went out of the room carrying Oryx like a precious vase and still muttering and scowling. But out on the street he laughed and made jokes about the man hopping around in his snarled-up trousers and told Oryx she was a good girl, and wouldn't she like to play this game again? So that became her game. She felt a little sorry for the men, although Uncle En said they deserved what happened to them, and they were lucky he never called the police. She somewhat regretted her part. But at the same time, she enjoyed it. It made her feel strong to know that the men thought she was helpless, but she was not. It was they who were helpless, they who would soon have to stammer apologies in their silly accents and hop around on one foot in their luxurious hotel rooms, trapped in their own pant legs with their bums sticking out, smooth bums and hairy bums, bums of different sizes and colors, while Uncle En berated them. From time to time they would cry. As for the money, they emptied their pockets, they threw all the money they had at Uncle En, they thanked him for taking it. They didn't want to spend any time in jail, not in that city, where the jails were not hotels and it took a very long time for charges to be laid and for trials to be held. They wanted to get into taxis as soon as they could, and climb onto big airplanes, and fly away through the sky. "Little Susu," Uncle En would say, as he set Oryx down on the street outside the hotel, "you are a smart girl. I wish I could marry you. Would you like that?" This was as close to love as Oryx could get right then, so she felt happy. But what was the right answer? Yes or no? She knew it was not a serious question, but a joke. She was only 5 or 6 or 7, so she couldn't get married. Anyway, the other children said that Uncle En had a grown-up wife who lived in a house elsewhere, and he had other children as well, his real children. They went to school. "Can I listen to your watch?" said Oryx with her shy smile. "Instead of," was what she meant. "Instead of marrying you, instead of answering your question, instead of being your real child." And he laughed some more, and he did let her listen to his watch, but she didn't hear any little voice inside. Pixieland Jazz. One day a different man came, one they'd never seen before. A tall, thin man, taller than Uncle En, with ill-fitting clothes and a pockmarked face, and said that all of them would have to come with him. Uncle En had sold his flower business, this man said, the flowers and the flower sellers and everything else. He'd gone away, he'd moved to a different city, so this tall man was the boss now. A year or so later, Oryx was told, by a girl who'd been with her the first weeks in the room with the mattresses and had turned up again in her new life, her life of movie-making, that this wasn't the real story. The real story was that Uncle En had been found floating in one of the city's canals with his throat cut. This girl had seen him. No, that was wrong. She hadn't seen him, but she knew somebody who had. There was no doubt about who it was. His stomach was puffed up like a pillow. His face was bloated, but it was Uncle En, all right. He had no clothes on. Someone must have taken them. Maybe someone else, not the one who'd cut his throat, or maybe the same one. Because what use did a corpse have for good clothes like his? No watch on him, either. "No money," the girl had said, and she'd laughed. "No pockets, so no money." "There were canals in the city?" Jimmy asked. He thought maybe that would give him a clue as to which city it had been. In those days, he'd wanted to know whatever it was possible to know about Oryx, about anywhere she'd been. He'd wanted to track down and personally injure anyone who had ever done harm to her or made her unhappy. He tortured himself with painful knowledge. Every white-hot factoid he could collect, he'd shoved up under his fingernails. The more it hurt, the more he was convinced he loved her. "Oh yes, there were canals," Oryx said. "The farmers used them, and the flower growers to get to the markets. They tied up their boats and sold what they had right there, right at the quays. That was a pretty sight, from a distance. So many flowers." She looked at him. She could often tell what he was thinking. "But a lot of cities have canals," she said, "and rivers. The rivers are so useful for the garbage and the dead people and the babies that get thrown away, and the shit." Although she didn't like it when he swore, she sometimes liked to say what she called bad words herself, because it shocked him. She had a large supply of bad words once she got going. "Don't worry so much, Jimmy," she added more gently. "It was a long time ago." More often than not, she acted as if she wanted to protect him from the image of herself, herself in the past. She liked to keep only the bright side of herself turned towards him. She liked to shine. So Uncle N had ended up in the canal. He'd been unlucky. He hadn't paid off the right people, or he hadn't paid them off enough. Or maybe they'd tried to buy his business, and the price was too low, and he wouldn't do it. Or his own men had sold him out. There were many things that could have happened to him. Or maybe it was nothing planned, just an accident, a random killing, just a thief. Uncle N had been careless. He'd gone out walking by himself, though he wasn't a careless man.
"I cried when I heard about it," said Oryx. "Poor Uncle N."
"Why are you defending him?" Jimmy asked. "He was vermin. He was a cockroach."
"He liked me.
He liked the money."
"Of course, Jimmy," said Oryx. "Everyone likes that. But he could have done much worse things to me, and he didn't do them. I cried when I heard he was dead. I cried and cried."
"What worse things? What much worse?"
"Jimmy, you worry too much."
The children were herded out of the room with the gray mattresses, and Oryx never saw it again. She never saw most of the other children again. They were divided up, and one went this way and one that. Oryx was sold to a man who made movies. She was the only one of them that went with the movie man. He told her she was a pretty little girl and asked how old she was, but she didn't know the answer to that. He asked her, wouldn't she like to be in a movie? She'd never seen a movie, so she didn't know whether she would like it or not, but it sounded like an offer of a treat, so she said yes. By this time, she was good at knowing when yes was the expected answer. The man drove her in a car with some other girls, three or four, girls she didn't know. They stayed overnight at a house, a big house. It was a house for rich people. It had a high wall around it with broken glass and barbed wire on the top, and they went in through a gate. Inside, it had a rich smell. "What do you mean, a rich smell?" Jimmy asked. But Oryx couldn't say. Rich was just a thing you learned to tell. The house smelled like the better hotels she'd been in. Many different foods cooking, wooden furniture, polishes and soap, all those smells mixed in. There must have been flowers, flowering trees or bushes nearby, because that was some of the smell. There were carpets on the floor, but the children didn't walk on them. The carpets were in a big room, and they went past the open door and looked in and saw them. They were blue and pink and red. Such beauty. The room they were put in was next to the kitchen. Perhaps it was a storeroom, or it had been one. There was the smell of rice and of the bags it was packed in, though no rice was in that room then. They were fed, better food than usual, said Oryx. There was chicken in it, and told not to make any noise. Then they were locked in. There were dogs at that house. You could hear them outside in the yard, barking. The next day, some of them went in a truck, in the back of a truck. There were two other children, both girls, both of them small like Oryx. One of them had just come from a village and missed her people there, and cried a lot, silently, hiding her face. They were lifted up into the back of the truck and locked in, and it was dark and hot, and they got thirsty, and when they had to pee, they had to do it in the truck, because there was no stopping. There was a little window, though, up high, so some air got in. It was only a couple of hours, but it seemed like more because of the heat and the darkness. When they got to where they were going, they were handed over to another man, a different one, and the truck drove off. "Was there any writing on it? The truck?" asked Jimmy, sleuthing.
"Yes, it was red writing."
"What did it say?"
"How would I know?"
said Oryx reproachfully. Jimmy felt foolish. "Was there a picture then?"
"Yes, there was a picture," said Oryx after a moment.
"A picture of what?" Oryx thought.
"It was a parrot. A red parrot."
"Flying or standing?"
"Jimmy, you are too strange."
Jimmy held on to it, this red parrot. He kept it in mind. Sometimes it would appear to him in reveries, charged with mystery and hidden significance, a symbol free of all contexts. It must have been a brand name, a logo. He searched the internet for parrot, parrot brand, parrot ink, red parrot. He found Alex the corknut parrot who'd said, "I'm going away now," but that was no help to him, because Alex was the wrong color. He wanted the red parrot to be a link between the story Oryx had told him and the so-called real world. He wanted to be walking along a street or trolling through the web in Eureka. There it would be, the red parrot, the code, the password, and then many things would become clear. The building where the movies were made, was in a different city, or it might have been in a different part of the same city, because the city was very big, said Oryx. The room she stayed in with the other girls was in that building, too. They almost never went outside, except up onto the flat roof sometimes when the movie was to be made up there. Some of the men who came to the building wanted to be outside while the movie was being filmed. They wanted to be seen, and at the same time they wanted to be hidden. The roof had a wall around it.
Maybe they wanted God to see them, said Oryx.
What do you think, Jimmy?
They were showing off to God?
I think so. These men all had ideas about what should be in their movie. They wanted things in the background, chairs or trees, or they wanted ropes, or screaming, or shoes. Sometimes they would say, "Just do it, I'm paying for it," or things like that, because everything in these movies had a price. Every hair bow, every flower, every object, every gesture. If the men thought up something new, there would have to be a discussion about how much that new thing ought to cost.
"So I learned about life," said Oryx.
"Learned what?" said Jimmy. He shouldn't have had the pizza and the weed they'd smoked on top of that. He was feeling a little sick.
"That everything has a price."
"Not everything. That can't be true. You can't buy time. You can't buy..." He wanted to say love, but hesitated. It was too soppy.
"You can't buy it, but it has a price," said Oryx. "Everything has a price."
"Not me," said Jimmy, trying to joke. "I don't have a price." Wrong, as usual. Being in a movie, said Oryx, was doing what you were told. If they wanted you to smile, then you had to smile. If they wanted you to cry, you had to do that too. Whatever it was, you had to do it, and you did it because you were afraid not to. You did what they told you to do to the men who came, and then sometimes those men did things to you. That was movies.
"What sort of things?" said Snowman.
"You know," said Oryx. "You saw. You have a picture of it."
"I only saw that one," said Snowman. "Only the one with you in."
"I bet you saw more with me in. You don't remember. I could look different. I could wear different clothes and wigs. I could be someone else, do other things."
"Like what else? What else did they make you do?"
"They were all the same, those movies," said Oryx.
She'd washed her hands. She was painting her nails now, her delicate, oval nails so perfectly shaped. Peach-colored, to match the flowered wrapper she was wearing. Not a smudge on her. Later on, she would do her toes. It was less boring for the children to make the movies than to do what they did the rest of the time, which was nothing much. They watched cartoons on the old DVD in one of the rooms, mice and birds being chased around by other animals that could never catch them, or they brushed and braided one another's hair, or they ate and slept. Sometimes other people came to use the space, to make different kinds of movies. Grown-up women came, women with breasts, and grown-up men, actors. The children could watch them making those movies if they didn't get in their way. Though sometimes the actors objected because the little girls would giggle at their penises. So big, and then sometimes, all of a sudden, so small. And then the children had to go back into their room. They washed a lot. That was important. They took showers with a bucket. They were supposed to be pure-looking. On a bad day, when there was no business, they would get tired and restless, and then they would argue and fight. Sometimes they'd be given a toke or a drink to calm them down. Beer, maybe, but no hard drugs. Those would shrivel them up, and they weren't allowed to smoke. The man in charge, the big man, not the man with the camera, said they shouldn't smoke because it would make their teeth brown. They did smoke sometimes anyway, because the man with the camera might give them a cigarette to share. The man with the camera was white, and his name was Jack. He was the one they mostly saw. He had hair like frayed rope, and he smelled too strong, because he was a meat eater. He ate so much meat. He didn't like fish. He didn't like rice either, but he liked noodles. Noodles with lots of meat. Jack said that where he came from, the movies were bigger and better, the best in the world. He kept saying he wanted to go home. He said it was only pure dumb chance he wasn't dead, that this fucking country hadn't killed him with its lousy food. He said he'd almost died from some disease he'd got from the water, and the only thing that had saved him was getting really, really pissed, because alcohol killed germs. Then he had to explain to them about germs. The little girls laughed about the germs because they didn't believe in them, but they believed about the disease because they'd seen that happen. Spirits caused it. Everyone knew that. Spirits and bad luck. Jack had not said the right prayers. Jack said he would get sick more often from the rotten food and water, only he had a really strong stomach. He said you needed a strong stomach in this business. He said the video cam was antique roadshow junk, and the lights were poor, so no wonder